My name is Jason Manning. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jason.
Thanks to God, AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since July 8th of 99. And let me get that out of here real quick, take a drink. I'm from Louisville, Texas. It's just right next to that. So anyway, thanks for inviting me to come out, Tim. I appreciate it. All your help with dinner, and that's, it really made me feel welcome. I appreciate that. Michael, it's glad to have you here. This is the beginning of a new life for you if you stick around and do some of the things that these guys have done around here. Visitors, always great. Mike, thanks for dinner. I appreciate that. It's great. Make sure I cover all my bases and get that out of the way right away. Because I'll probably start thinking about myself here pretty quick, and then I'll forget about all the people I'm supposed to thank. So, I talked to my sponsor on Tuesday night, and he always reminds me that a lot of these things are taped, and a lot of these things get back to him, so he'll know what I'm doing up here. So, I was gonna tell you, a lot of people heard my wife last week, or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was, and then tonight you'll get to hear the truth. So, that's the. The thing about it is I started drinking at about 12 years old, not for real, but I drank my first time, got drunk the first time I was 12 years old. I have a family that I always accuse them of being guilty of loving me way too much. They're good people, mom and dad who stayed married until all the kids were grown. They did what they were supposed to do and gave us a great house. You know, I had plenty of food and plenty of clothes and I just thought about myself way too much, even from the very beginning. When I was real little, I used to honestly believe that I was the only real human being in the world, right? I mean, for real, that was my thought in my head, was that there was like cameras and things. I mean, I was telling you about this. I really honestly believe there was people and things or something watching over me, and things didn't start until I came into, you know, like, nothing was really real until I came about and came into the room. And this is, I'm like 6, 7, 8. I mean, this is my whole, up until I ever took a drink. And thank God I got to take a drink. And some of those crazy ideas went away. But I believe that I was the only real thing in the world. And I didn't know that was a bad thing until I got sober and got a sponsor and found out that. I was 12 years old, and I'd been at a movie theater with some buddies of mine, and it was probably, I guess I wasn't 12 yet. I was middle school. I was at this movie theater, and there was a bunch of guys that I had gone to grade school with, and they were drinking. There's a movie theater downtown. There's a big walking mall, and they were drinking. And they, you know, you tell your parents you go to the movies, you go, you get dropped off, and you don't go in, and you spend your $5. And anyway, we watched these guys that were drunk, and some of them were older, some were younger, and I watched them have a pretty good time, and I watched a lot of people, and we ended up walking a couple of them up and down, and, you know, I was never going to drink type of deal. I was just going to, but I saw how much attention they got and how cool it was, and I just never was real cool, so I thought I better start maybe thinking about drinking. And my other friend that I grew up with in grade school had moved away out into the mountains, and he was turning 12 in March. That's the only reason I remember this deal, is because there's this 12-year birthday thing, and kind of all falls into place. And I turned 12 in October, and it was right around that time when school started up, and those kids had gotten drunk. And anyway, long story short, I started planning to get drunk at my buddy's 12-year birthday party when he was turning 12 in March. And so I did some math. There's supposed to be 12 kids there. I mean, this is kind of the only way I remember it, but 12 kids there. And I saw those guys drink 2 or 3 beers, and I figured, so we needed about 2 beers apiece. That'd be about 12, 24 beers, you know, for the weekend at this buddy's birthday party. And so I started stealing them, skimming them off the top. My parents, they didn't drink much. My grandmother, on the other hand, is a crazy drunk, and the only alcoholic that I know that's probably claimed being an alcoholic in our whole family. She's the kind of drunk that gets drunk and calls you on the phone, like, forever, like, back to back, and just makes you... I mean, then you're 6, 7 years old, and your grandmother's calling you up and telling you what you haven't done, you know, over the last 6 years, and it's bad. She terrorized our family. It was horrible. I hated her. I hated her with every passion, but I always got dumped off at her house. That was, you know, it was always when my parents wanted to go, that's where I went, and so I had to spend all that time with her. And so you love this woman utterly for raising you up and taking good care of you, but when she got drunk, she was just a maniac. I mean, just brutal. And So I started stealing. She drank this beer called Bergy beer. I don't know if they have it in Texas. It's $5 a case. It just says Bergy on the can. It's a white can, and I think it's blue, and it has a white eye or a red eye on it. And anyway, so I started stealing them. And I acquired 24 beers over that six-month period or whatever it was until my buddy's birthday. And how I got out of the house and with a suitcase or whatever, I don't remember how it happened, but I ended up getting it to his house. And by chance, my buddy had the same idea. So he had about that much, too. And his dad drank a lot. Rainier beer, which is, that's a classic. It's good stuff, and cheap and good. And so he had about that much, and there was 12 of us, and we started drinking. And my intentions at that night were to drink those two beers and get drunk, fall down, you know, have a good time, and then get talked about for a long period of time. And what happened to me was, as I started drinking, and nobody else seemed to be drinking, and so you know my other buddy started drinking with me, and we started drinking, and we just kept drinking and kept drinking. And I don't know what the situation was or how. I don't know how we never really got in trouble for this deal, because his parents, I think they just turned us loose in the basement and locked the doors and just basically we're going to come in the morning. Hopefully we'd all be alive. And they must. Somebody knew something was up. I mean, now that I think about it more and more, somebody knew something was up. And so we got drunk, and his dad had a collection of videos, and we got naked, and we ran around in the fireplace. And I mean, they had a pool table, and they had firearms, and I mean it was a great party. I drank a lot more than those two beers, I know that. And I woke up in the morning, and they had a three-story house, and I was on the middle floor. I woke up on top of the wash machine, and my buddy was on the dryer, and we had a bottle of Jack Daniels, half a bottle of Jack Daniels between the two of us. And I had no idea, completely naked. I mean, it was the most bizarre thing that. And I, like I said, I planned to drink just two beers. That was my deal. And I got a huge amount of attention, and I became the cool drunk kid at school. And that was what happened. It was awesome. I mean, I went back to school, and those kids talked about me for years. And I just kept doing it, you know, every time I had a chance after that, because I fit in. I was cool. Come to find out, I really wasn't all that cool. I mean, I still think I was a legend in my own mind. But it was pretty neat, and it was an eye-opening experience, and I stopped thinking about myself. I mean, up until that point, like I was saying, I thought about myself all the time. I literally talked to myself all the time. I mean, it was just constant. I would actually, when I was like 6, 8, 7, 8 years old, I would tell myself, "Don't talk to yourself. You know, just don't do it." And then you know you'd be "Oh yeah, you're doing it again, man." You know and when I drank, I stopped talking to myself. I mean, I literally stopped. It just didn't happen anymore. And so I love to drink, and that's how I did it. I drank a lot. I was in, I guess, the middle school. I started dating girls, and that was pretty cool too. That's my other kind of deal. And so I would drink and date girls, and I get with these really healthy girls that were, you know, really into good relationships, and it was sick. I mean, we would break up, and I would try to kill myself, and then I'd go get locked up in the psychiatric unit, and then I'd come out, and we'd get back together, and we'd break up, and she'd try to kill herself, and she'd go. I mean, it was like that for 2 or 3 years with this girl. I mean, I was in and out of that place all the time, and I'd cut up and a lot of pills, and it was just really a bad deal. And it was the middle 80s, I guess, and insurance companies, it was big to send your kids to treatment. All my friends went to treatment in the 80s when I was in middle school and high school. Everybody that I knew went to a treatment center, and but I was in that psychiatric unit this time. It was a bad deal. I'd taken a bunch of aspirin. I cut my wrists up, and I went in, and they gave me an evaluation, and I told them I drank a little bit. And the truth was, that night that I tried to kill myself, I couldn't find something to drink, and I was in bad shape. I didn't know that until after I got sober, and I talked to my sponsor about some things. But I was really uncomfortable, really, really uncomfortable from not having a chance to drink. And so I got real. I was pretty close to doing myself in, and I ended up getting arrested, and I got put in the psychiatric unit, and I got locked up. And they asked me if I drank, and I said a little bit, and they said, "Your dad's insurance will pay for this if you want to go to a treatment center." And so I got shipped off to a treatment center. I was probably 16 years old, and I went to that treatment center, and I was on fire. I mean, it was awesome. They put you in there. They feed you all the time. You know, they pat you on the back. They give you cigarettes. It's a cool place. I mean, it was awesome. And I was on, you know, 16 years old. Didn't have to go to school. Didn't have to do any of that. You just go in there, and if I said the right thing and did the right thing, they stayed off my back. And I actually, you know, got to the top of the level or whatever it is. I set all my steps in order, and you know, I was cool in treatment. And And I had it by the horn. And I was really, when I left there, I really honestly believed that I was going to stay sober. I really did. I really thought I'm going to get out of here and I'm going to go back to Helena, which was about 4.5 hours from where I got where I was living. And I got in the car with my parents and we drove home and I was telling them all about it. And we're, you know, they had gone to the family week and it was real cool. And I got home and for some reason I wanted to go do something and go to an AA meeting or something. It was really stupid. And we got into this huge fight. And we lived about 3 or 4 hours, a walk probably from my house into the town. And I got in this huge fight and I slammed the door and left the house. And I walked all the way into town and I was coming around the corner. I mean, 3 hours plus to drive 8, maybe 10 hours out of the treatment center. And I come around the corner and my buddy come around. He had this 1971 green Chevelle and he pulled up in there and he had just scored a big bag of weed. And I was smoking dope, you know, 10 hours out of treatment. And I was going to stay sober forever, you know. And I kicked around. I went to some AA meetings after that. There was about a year in there when I was in school. They had a program in school where if you went to this program, you could kind of get out of some of your classes. And so I went to that. And the guy that was there was 20 years sober. And he had suggested I go to some meetings with this group of kids. And we hung out for a while. I had a pretty good time. And I was making coffee at the meeting and drinking after the meeting. And I just didn't really do what they asked me to do. And they were probably saying exactly what I hear in AA today, but I wasn't concerned about it. I was just trying to get my parents off my back so I could get back to doing what I was doing. And what happened was I found a real nice girl in AA. Don't recommend that to anybody. She was a real nice lady, and she got, well, let me back up. I was in AA in 1989, about 6 months, and then I met her, and she got pregnant, and we had a baby, and I had moved out of my house. It was between my junior and senior in high school. I was living on my own with a buddy of mine, and we were going to get sober together, and we were going to get our lives together, and he'd just come out of another treatment center. We were moving together in this apartment complex, underage, you know, thinking we had the world by the horns, and we moved in together, and we were going to AA, and we were doing the things. I was making the coffee and showing up and doing that stuff again. And I came home one night after a meeting, and he had a huge house full of people, and they were drinking, and that's what I did. So I started drinking again, and I spent about 3 or 4 months there that summer before I went back to high school, really getting sick. I mean, I was doing some bad stuff and drinking a whole bunch, and I lost a lot of weight. I was weighing about 110, 115 pounds, and in that period of time, I met my wife and. Now and she got pregnant and I moved back home because I wasn't going to go back to high school, and I was just going to go back home and get myself together for a little bit. And my mom had to take care of me and nurse me back, you know, basically nurse me back to health, kept me in bed for a couple of 3 weeks and fed me and just kept me back enough so I could go back to school. And as soon as I got to feeling better, Janetta called me and said she was pregnant, and I said, well, you need me to come live with you. And so I left my parents' house and moved in with her. And I spent my senior year in high school with a woman who was in AA, and I was drinking. And she was about 3 years sober, I think, at the time, 3 or 4 years sober. And, I drank every weekend. I mean, I worked full-time, went to high school full-time, went through. That's where I guess when I started taking action to do things to look good, you know, to keep everything together. At that point, I started going to school and I worked a full-time job, and I got out of high school. My son was born about 2 months before I got out of high school, and I spent those 2 years, his first 2 years of his life, working in a kitchen, cooking and drinking and doing as much other stuff as I could possibly do. And my wife stayed with me. I mean, she threatened to leave me all the time, and it was a miserable life. I mean, I worked nights, or I worked mornings, and she worked nights, and then I'd work nights, and she'd work days. We never were home. We'd just bring this little kid between the two of us, you know, here, I'm going to work, I'm going to work, and that's basically how it was. And it was miserable, and it got to a point where, I guess, 2 years out of high school, she decided that the first time that she really put her foot down and said, I'm leaving, you know, I'm taking this kid, and I'm done with you. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? That's a little rash, don't do that. And so she put an ultimatum on the table. She said, you can either go to college or you can join the military. And I'd already been to school, and I worked real hard in school. I didn't want to do any more school, so I joined the Coast Guard. And it's not really the military. I mean, it is. I call it the military, but it was a cool job. And I got her to come back, you know, and I went off to boot camp, and I came out of boot camp, and my thinking is that it was like 8 weeks of not drinking, and they don't let you smoke in boot camp. At a certain point, they used to let you smoke in boot camp. It was a regular thing, and they didn't do that when I went in there, and it was tough. It was a tough 8 weeks. And I got out, and they told us when we left boot camp that if you wore a uniform on the plane, they won't ask you how old you are, and you can drink, and they'll give you free drinks. So I got drunk out of boot camp and flew to Seattle, spent the night in Seattle, and had to have somebody wake me up in the airport to get me back to Montana to pick up my wife so we could move, you know, to Seattle. And I ended up getting stationed out there on a boat. They call it a boat. It was my life for 2 years. I mean, I lived on that thing. It was 400 feet, and we sailed all the time. I mean, it was like in the Navy, they you knew you were leaving for 6 months, you know, and then you'd be home for 6 months. In the Coast Guard, you come home, and you're home like 2 weeks, and they say, we got to go. And you get on the boat, and you go. And so I spent, 2 years I probably was gone at least way more than half of that time. I mean, over a year and a half of it probably on the ship. And the great thing for me is that I got to drink, because you don't drink when you're floating, but as soon as you pull in, they expect you to. There was a guy that spoke in one of the first conferences I was in from McKinney, Texas. And I've not been able to find him yet. I've been looking for him. 20 years sober, this guy. And he came up there and spoke, and he said when he joined the Navy, it was like joining the World Series of drinking. And for me, it was exactly that way. I mean, I love the Coast Guard, because they just allow you to drink. I mean, every pier that we pull into, there's a bar right there. 50-cent drinks. You can drink there all afternoon and then go, you know, out to the town and not spend too much money. And but I spent a lot of time in Alaska and a lot of time in the Caribbean. And for some reason, the ATM machines weren't connected to our bank in Washington. So I could go in and I could pull $200 out in the morning, $200 in the afternoon, and $200 in the evening time. And they just thought it was the same $200, I guess, because I never had that much money in the bank. And and I would call my wife and say, you know, I'm getting these sailor tattoos. That was the big thing. Everybody was getting these tattoos. And I never could make it to the tattoo shop. I mean, I would get to the bar and I would drink. And I could drink up $600 in 3 or 4 days easy. I mean, it was not a problem. And especially a guy like me, because I like to be cool, you know, so I'm always buying other people drinks and trying to be what I'm not. And then what would happen is my wife would go to write a check in Seattle for groceries and this 2-year-old baby, and she couldn't get, they wouldn't take her check. You know, and I had no idea I was doing this stuff. All I knew is that they would send these return checks to the bank or to the boat, and my boss would come down and ask me about it. And I said, I don't know what she's doing with that money. I have no idea. She's writing bad checks. And they said, well, we can throw you out for this. And I said, well, I'll get her in line, you know. And I had no idea what I was doing to that family. And then I'll tell you more about it as I go. But I got transferred off that boat because it was getting bad again. You know, she's ready to leave me again. And I said, well, I'll go to school, learn a trade. And we moved to the East Coast. And I was still in the Coast Guard, but I was home every night. And out there where I worked a job where you went to work about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. You were off at 1 o'clock. And it was a mechanic shop in the back end. And they had two refrigerators, and they kept beer in there. So we drank at 1:30, 2 o'clock every day. It was the best job ever. I mean, it was awesome. You worked 4 or 5 hours, and you drank 4 or 5 hours, and you went home. And we traveled a lot. I got to go a lot of different places. And on the government, they give you about $110 a day for per diem. And you can get a hotel with 5 guys for $35, you know. And you do the math. It's not hard to figure out how much you can drink a day. And that's what I did for another 2 years. And it got real bad. Some of the guys that I was working with, all of them were divorced. And they hated, they talked about that He-Man's Woman Hater Club. You know, that was their theme there. Because they just were a bunch of miserable guys. And they started passing around this book about this guy who had killed himself or killed his wife in Florida. And he bought a chipper shredder, and he froze his wife, and he put her in pieces, and he fed her into the swamp, and I guess all they found was a fingernail, and they couldn't prove that he did it, because there wasn't enough evidence. And so I started reading this thing, and I started getting the idea, I got real sick. I mean, it was real bad. I was planning this deal, and I was going to do it. I mean, that was really my thinking. And my wife, I think she kind of caught on to it, because she, one night in a drunken stupor, I mean, my story is I never drove drunk, because my wife said she'd always leave me if I ever came home drunk after driving, and I said, oh, I never did. So she drove me a lot of places. And I call her from a lot of weird places, had her come pick me up. But I used to tell her all the time, I said, you know, tonight we're going to go over here and I'm going to have a party with my boss, and I need you to not let me drink liquor. Because when I drank liquor, I always got out of control. I always did bad things. I'd hit on my boss's wife or hit somebody or do something, you know, that I wasn't supposed to do. And so I would go there and we start drinking, and I'd lose her somewhere in the crowd, and I'd be upstairs doing shots. And that's the way I drank. I mean, that's the way I like to drink, is to get obliterated drunk. I don't know where I was going with that, but so I'm planning this deal and trying to, I guess, in a drunken stupor one night, coming home from that party, I would assume, and I mentioned that I needed to get a chipper shredder, and I needed to get it for the house, and she's like, well, you know, the people on the base, they take care of all that stuff. They come and cut the trees. We really don't need one. I said, we probably need one, and for somewhere, I mean, this woman was, she was insane. I mean, she's like 7-8 years sober and sponsoring like 50 women. I mean, literally 50 women. And this house, my house was invaded with AA people, and I'm drinking like a fish. And I'd come home every day drunk, and many times I'd pass out. And she was mean. I mean, she used to, one time I passed out in the bathroom, my favorite place, because it's tile, you know, and you get that nice cold tile on your face, and you're in business. A little humidity, kind of cool. You can sleep there for hours. And I passed out up there in this house. We just had it retiled, and she's standing. I was supposed to fix dinner. My mother-in-law was there. I was supposed to fix dinner, and I came home just trashed. And she didn't. One of the kids needed. We only had one bathroom, and I was in there, and the kids needed to use it. And it was the middle of the daytime. Usually they could go out in the trees and use the trees, but that day, for some reason, she wanted me out of there. And so she decided the window was open, and she was outside with her mother and some people, and she decided she'd put the hose on me. You know, and I'm up there sleeping. I was just minding my own business. And the hose come in. I mean, I didn't know it. The next thing I know, I'm just the cold water from the spring. I was just covered. I come tumbling out and smacking my head. And I hated her. God, I hated her. And, you know, the thing about it is she came up later and apologized and put me to bed and took good care of me. I mean, she is a good wife. But, I mean, my perception was she needs to be put in a chipper shredder. And we ended that stay in Massachusetts probably around I guess it was 97 I think 97 98 when I got out of the service, because it was the same deal. You know, she said, we're going to move back home and you can either come with us or, you know, because I do really well in structured environments. I was awesome in the military. I mean, I was a Bhutanese six at 4 years. I mean, I was going to make the next rank, and I had to go to a boat to get more rank is basically what it was. And she knew what it was like when I was on the boat. And that was a bad deal, because I drank 10 times worse than I did when I was home every night. And I did a lot of other things when I'm not supervised. So what happened was she said, we're moving home. And I got out of service and used my GI Bill, signed up for college. And we moved back to Montana in this little town, Butte, Montana. It's an old copper mine, and it's a hard-drinking town. Boy, I'm telling you, it's awesome. And I spent a year in college, and that's what I did. I went to college really hard, just like I did everything else. I was super, superman in college. I mean, I'd go 2 or 3 days and study, take a test, and then I'd go drink for a couple of days, and I'd get it together again, and I would go study, and get drunk again, and I did that for a whole year, and it was bad. I mean, I would wake up every morning wanting to put the pillow over my wife's head. I just was so miserable. I just could not stand it, and she obviously was too, because we were married in 97. We were married 6 or 7 years, something like that. And she really left me. I mean, for real this time. She really took the kids. I came home one day and they were gone. And there was like, no, none of this, you know, I'll be here, call me later, you know. And she had done that a million times. But this time she really packed her stuff and left me. And I'm laying there. I went to my dad's house and I was laying on his couch and I was pretty sick. I'd been drinking. I mean, I'd been drinking a bunch. And I just didn't know what to do. And the reason my sobriety date is July 8th, today's your birthday, Mitch, happy birthday. That's a pretty big deal. About that same time, I was staying on my dad's couch, and he was just disgusted with me. He's just like, you know, you need to do something with yourself. You can't keep doing this to those kids. We'd had another kid in the process, and I didn't get to tell that story about him. But when we were in Massachusetts, I used to drink a bunch, and my wife worked. So we had this piece of carpet. Let's tell this real quick. We had this piece of carpet, and we had hardwood floor on this side. And she would leave and go to work, and I was stuck with a baby and my older boy. He was probably 4 or 5. And in the summertime, I'd put him to bed 6 o'clock at night because I knew he'd just be too much in my way, and I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. But this baby, you can't just put a baby in the other room. It's not right? That's not what parents do. So the TV was here and the couch was here, and I fit perfectly in between. There was this piece of hardwood, and I put that baby in there, and then I would drink. And then if I passed out, he couldn't, I could feel him crawling over me, and I knew I could get up. And I did that for 2 years while I would live there. And that kid, I would wake up, and a few times he'd spilled my beer over. He'd be sitting in that puddle splashing. Kids, he's doomed. But you wake up, and you're drunk, and you kind of see it, and it just doesn't feel right. It's really a bad thing. You shouldn't do that. So I'd clean him up real quick and put him to bed, and my wife got home about 10 o'clock at night, and I'd be passed out in the chair watching TV. And that's what I did for 2 years. I mean, I didn't think it was a bad thing because I was going to work every day. I was paying the bills. We had 2 cars. We had a nice house. That's what guys are supposed to do. And I didn't think I was doing a bad thing. And so anyway, we're back in college, and she left me. And I had remembered, for some reason, she said, you're going to do something about your life or we're never going to come back. I'd gotten back in contact with her, and I knew some people in AA because she'd been in AA the whole time. I mean, my wife, she's sober a long time, and she knew some people, her sponsor, and some of those people were back in another town real close to where I got sober. So I called up one of these guys that I had met a couple months before, and I asked him about, I didn't ask him. I went to another meeting. I wasn't going to go to their meeting and be a part of that. I wouldn't want them to know how lame I really was. And I went to another meeting that I'd been to years and years ago when I was in high school. And I was in this meeting, and the only reason I remember it was because there was a lady there that I had been in aftercare with who was getting her 10-year chip. And I was like, man, it's been a long time. I'm not the kind of guy who was in and out of AA. I just was out. I didn't come in. I never came back. I was around AA a lot with my wife, but I just never went because I wasn't like her. Man, she's a sick drunk. If you heard her, man, she's the kind of lady who gets thrown in jail. And I mean, she had to get sober when she was 16. She was in so much trouble, I mean, I never got a DUI. I never, never did those bad things that drunk people do. So I got a hold of this guy, and somehow I ended up in a meeting with him, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor today. His name's Kurt Klotz, and if I don't say his name on the tape, I'll be in trouble later. So that's... Anyway, he got me busy when I first came to AA, because when I was here the first time, I didn't really know what was wrong with me. I really didn't know what was wrong with me when I got here the second time. I was just trying to get my wife back. I didn't want to have to do my own laundry, really, is what it came down to. And I needed her back in the house to take care of me. And so I got there, and he asked me to do a few things from the very first time I asked him to sponsor me that night. I lived in Butte. I had to drive home, and he told me to call him in the morning at 7:15. That was our... I had no idea what that meant, and then lead into a whole bunch of phone calls after that. But so I called him in the morning, and he said, "What are you going to do today?" And I said, "I'm going to go to school. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this." And he said, "You need to get to a meeting and call me tomorrow morning." And I said, "Okay." So and we started the journey. That's what we started doing. I started doing what he asked me to do. I had no idea what I was getting into. I was just thinking that if I did what he asked me to do for now, my wife came back home and we were living together again, and things were going to get better, and I was going to be able to drink again. Really, is what it came down to. So he set up an appointment for me once a week, which was an hour away from where I lived. I drove over to meet with him, and we sat down, and he started reading this book to me, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, one page at a time. Started on the first page where there's blank. Probably everybody's heard this stupid joke, but he said, "This is what you know about AA, and we're going to teach you the rest of it." So we started through the book. He started reading it to me. And what I came to find out, in the doctor's opinion, there's a bunch of this identification stuff that goes on. And they talk a lot about the physical allergy of alcoholism, something I had no idea. No idea that that's what qualifies me for this deal. Because I really what I thought was you had to be like my grandmother. You had to be one of those people who just made everybody's life miserable. Or you had to be like my wife. You had to have DUIs and steal cars and beat people up and do all those horrible things. And I didn't do that. I was in the military. I got promoted. I paid my bills. I did everything that I was supposed to do, except I drank a whole bunch. And when I drank a whole bunch, I forgot about everything else in my life, and I treated it like that. So he told me about this deal that when alcoholic people start to drink, they can't stop drinking. Mike mentioned it earlier. I mean, that's... Normal people don't have that. I mean, and what I did is I got to look back the very first time I was 12 years old. I was only planning on drinking 2 beers. Two beers. That was it. I was not going to drink anymore. And I ended up on top of a washer naked with a half a bottle of Jack Daniels. I drank alcoholically. And I did that every single time, almost every single time that I drank. And that puts me on that page and understand, okay, I got maybe that's what happens to me when I drink. But I'm still not really alcoholic. I'm not really that bad. And so we went into some more of the book, and he read some more stuff to me, and I started identifying with this other stuff of every time that I wasn't drinking, I was pretty uncomfortable. I was pretty miserable. And what happens to me when I get miserable and uncomfortable, I got to take a drink again. And then I take a drink, and then I'm miserable and uncomfortable, and I got to stop drinking. And then it's just repetitive, and it happens like that over and over and over again. And what it does is that when I drink, I can't stop drinking, and when I stop drinking, I can't stop thinking about drinking. So here I am in that place, and they talk about it over and over and over in AA meetings. I guess that to me is what powerless is. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And thank God this book has more than two paragraphs or two chapters to it, because there is a whole bunch of stuff in here that can happen to you afterwards. And I didn't know that. I had no idea. I had no idea that I was alcoholic until I could identify, I guess, with those two things. Thank God, because my impression of what it is, I'd have been screwed for the rest of my life. I would have just kept on doing what I was doing and ended up, somebody mentioned something about dying. And the sad thing about alcoholics is you don't normally die. You got to live miserably for years and years and years. You really got to hang in there, and it's not fun. It doesn't look pretty. And so he took me through there, and we got to do some other stuff, a fun fourth and fifth step. And I got to write down all my stuff, and I got to say that in front of him. And I didn't realize that, that he was ever going to bring it back up again. I thought it says in there one time, doesn't it? I mean, that's what the step says. You just admit one time to somebody else and God, and that's not what it's about. I mean, he started talking to me about this stuff on a regular basis, and I had to write down some amends. And my sponsor is the kind of guy that doesn't think I can do anything right, which is right, on my own. And so I had to write my amends, and I'd write them out, and then I'd take them to him. And he would read through it, and he'd take like a school kid and write through it, red marker in this, you can't say this, or you'll be making another amends, and you can't do this, or you'll be doing this. And so I got to make those amends in that fashion to my wife. 6 months sober, six to eight months sober, I was doing my fifth step with him, and my wife, somewhere on the line there, she decided she didn't want to be married anymore. And it's like 6 months sober. I was miserable. I was ready to drink again. And somebody mentioned a story about lying. I mean, here I was in an AA conference for like 3 days straight, and I wasn't telling my sponsor something about my wife. And I spent 24 hours a day for 3 days doing AA. And I went home on a Sunday night. This was about 3 or 4 months sober. I went home on a Sunday night, and I had saved a half a bottle of Crown Royal. That's what I like to drink when I was, being sophisticated type of thing. So I saved that because I really wasn't ever going to quit drinking. And I ended up on the porch that night. It was about 11 o'clock at night because we had to drive from the same place I was in treatment to this other place. And I ended up on the porch, and I was crying my eyeballs out, and my wife went to bed, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I guess my sponsor tells me that I guess I was doing enough at that time that I knew enough to call him. And I called him, and we dumped the bottle out. And it was, long story short, but the truth is, I was lying. And I'm not the kind of guy who will just flat out lie to you. I just won't talk to you. That's the way I am. I'm a lying by omission, I think, is the way you do it. You just don't tell the truth. You don't ever say anything, and that works out pretty good, too. And I found out that keeping secrets is the biggest deal that'll kick your butt around here. It really does. So anyway, he took me through the steps. I made amends to my wife and my kids, and so my wife decided she didn't want to be married, and I think she was going to go be with somebody else, and that was my perception, my thinking. And I got some email stuff, and I got really upset, and I got a gun and a bat and some other things, and I was going to go hurt somebody. And that was 6 months sober, right? And I was working the steps, had a sponsor, doing all this stuff, and I was going to kill somebody again. And I drove around in this other town, which is about an hour from where I lived, drove around in circles with these two baby boys in the back seat, ranting and raving. And then they're telling me just the other day that they remembered it. I didn't think they would remember that kind of stuff. And I drove around ranting and raving and going in and out of these stores, and you just wait here, I'll be back, Anyway, finally that evening I called my sponsor, and I actually ended up staying with him for a couple of weeks. And I had to, because what I had done is kidnap my kids is what I did. I took them from my wife and told her she could never see him again, and she would never see him again. And And I ended up having to take them back and make some amends and do some things there. And anyway, long story short, we ended up working things out, and we ended up back together again. I have a tendency with these sick women. And I was about a year sober, I think, maybe a little over a year sober. And some of the things in the ninth step started kicking me in the butt, and I wasn't doing it. And I had to actually finish my original list, and I didn't think that AA was working. I mean, I was miserable. I was miserable the first year. It sucked. It was hard doing all those things that he asked me to do. And I'm outside, and it was the year that they had these huge forest fires in Montana. I was outside taking care of the grass out there at this complex where we lived. I worked and went to school. I was being, you know, super guy again. And it was real bad. I have terrible allergies, and my face was swollen up, and I was dirty and miserable. And you know, if you remember, I used to lock my kid in his room and do some horrible things to those kids. And I'm outside in the yard and mowing the grass. I'm coming across the yard to put it away, and my little boy is like 8 or 9 years old at the time. And he came up to me, and he looked at me with that look in his face again. You know, he's like 7, 8 years old, and he said, "Dad, you look like you're drunk." You know, and this is like a year after I quit drinking. I thought, man, he didn't even remember me drinking. And I just looked him in the eyes and tried to give him a little bit of confidence. And I said, "Dad, I'm not." All right, I said, "Son, I'm not drinking. I'm not drunk." And he looked me in the eyes, big eyes, got a smile, and he said, "Dad, that's good." You know, and he turned and he went and ran off and played with his friends. And just for that one moment, I guess I knew AA worked. You know, it was working. It was actually doing what they had promised me it would do. I hadn't taken a drink for over a year. I was in bad shape. I really didn't think this deal worked. And for one moment, I get to go to another meeting the next day. You know, it was one of those kind of deals. And I knew that AA was working. And I started hanging out with a bunch of guys back home and doing what they were doing and being a part of it. And it just, it got good. It really, my life is an awesome deal right now. I was able to get through college and went to a lot of meetings and I had that regular meeting with my sponsor every week. And, you know, I've since I got out of college, I got a job in West Texas, way the heck out. I mean, it's a god awful place. It's like 1,000 people live there. There's no AA meetings, and the closest meetings was Midland, Texas, which was 90 miles one way. And I went to 3 meetings a week for 2 years, and I hated it. It was the bane of my existence. Three nights a week I'd get off work at 5 o'clock, and I'd get in the car, and then I wouldn't see my kids. I'd drive to town. Two hours in, an hour and a half in, 2 hour meeting, turn around, drive an hour and a half back, and I was just like, this sucks. I mean, it was just horrible, and for somewhere along the line, I was talking to my sponsor, doing what I was asked to do, and an opportunity came up. The company I was working for sold the field that I was working in, and another company bought it, and another company came and offered me a job in Dallas, and so I thought, well, I heard there's a lot of meetings in Dallas, so. It was a good move for us. It was really a good move for us to be able to come and move here and get an opportunity. I have a great job. I work a lot of hours, and it's a tough job for some of the things that I have to do there. But it's you know, they put me in a position where I can be home with the kids every night. When they're in school, I can do their functions and be a part of their life. And for these kids that just didn't want anything to do with me, you know, really. I mean, they just had no idea. This wife of mine has put up with me for, I guess we've been married, we got married in 92, so 12 years, 11 years, something like that. And they like to be with me. You know, it's important to them that I'm home every night and that I'm a part of their life. And, you know, and I know it's all because of coming here and doing what they asked me to do, because this deal just doesn't make any sense. I mean, really, when I got here, I had wife problems, you know, and before that, I had drinking problems, and before that, I had drug problems, and I had sex problems, and I had all kinds of problems. And so I really thought when I first came back, my wife just said, "You need to do something." And I really thought that the best thing for me would be to go to like a multi-counselor type of thing so I could deal with all my problems. Because I was in bad shape. I had no idea. And what I found out is that I had alcoholism based on those two facts. When I drank, I couldn't stop drinking. And when I stopped drinking, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And that if I was going to do something about that, or, you know, and recover from that, or to have any type of life at all, I was going to have to do the rest of the steps and stick around AA for the rest of my life, basically. And that didn't sound like a very good idea. I mean, it just doesn't, it's not cool, you know? And somewhere along the line, it became pretty cool. You know, I don't know where it happened, but it's the neatest place in the world. I mean, these are the greatest people on the face of the earth. And the thing about it is that people in AA will do absolutely anything for you. Like you're talking about your buddy, you know, that twisted off. And what I found about in AA is that if I'm willing to show up and do my part of it, people bend over backwards over and over and over again. But as soon as I turn my back and start doing something different, you know, what's the point? Why should I waste my time? There's people here that are willing to do it. I got to spend my time there. And that's, I'm grateful that you're here, Michael. This is, I mean, if you weren't here, what would be the point? You know, I mean, it says something in the book that we meet often so that the newcomer can find us. I mean, that's the big deal. And so you can, when you come in here, you know it's here. And that there are people here that don't drink anymore. They probably drank just like you did. And that's really all it is. All you got to do is just crawl in their back pocket and do what they do. Thank you.